You are listening to a free podcast of The Majority Report with Sam Cedar. To support the show and receive nearly an hour extra material daily, become a member today at majority.fm. Resistance is futile.
The Majority Report with Sam Cedar. It's time to look in the mirror, America. Do you like what you see?
I keep referring to Obama as the magic Negro.
Do you like what you see now?
Well, suck on this.
It's just a mirror, America.
Shared sacrifice by everybody.
What could it do to you except reflect your image?
I did nothing wrong at the Minneapolis airport.
The Majority Report.
Far more credible to me than PBS
and Frontline.
The Majority Report with Sam Cedar.
And I get the feeling you've been cheated.
It is Thursday, July 18th, 2013. My name is Sam Cedar. This is the award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live in the literal, though not metaphorical, shadow of the New York Times building in the fashionable Dollar Lunch District of New York City. Today on the program, Jeff Goodell, Goodbye Miami, the future of Miami, and really the story of all of our futures, living or not so living with global climate change. Also on the program today, more benefits to the Affordable Care Act, as far as I'm concerned. We told you yesterday about for New York staters, the benefits of health care reform. Another bonus. More people may quit their jobs. Also on the program today, more grand bargain talks? Really? Still? Why? And the fallout from the filibuster deal and a really poignant op-ed in the New York Times from the grandfather of the 16-year-old American citizen killed by our government's drone program. And the opening salvo of the fight against the TPP. All that and more on today's program. Ladies and gentlemen, I haven't done this in a while. I haven't had cause to, or to the extent that I've had cause to, I have showed some self-restraint. But I just had to because I just found this so obnoxious. And I was going to, we had a post on our Facebook page that I was going to let slide until I realized that this person has emailed me multiple times in the past. And so I'm just going to have on it. We got a post on our Facebook page complaining you want $10 for your podcast and yet use Ring of Fire interviews. And yes, on occasion we will use an interview that ran on Ring of Fire. More often than not, it is actually an extended interview that we did. So you didn't hear the old interview on Ring of Fire. On Monday, you take off and have Matt and Michael provide good interviews and content. That's right. I do. Over the summer, I am taking Mondays off, sort of part of a paternity leave, quite frankly, helping deal with my new son. Finally, you have a new interview on Wednesday. No, actually, we had a new interview on Tuesday. It just happened to be that we pre-recorded it because it's easier for scheduling purposes. She continues, Tom Hartman is less expensive and has gone half as much time as you take off. And you are just getting started, so to speak. Well, no, I don't know what you mean by so to speak. I've been doing this for 9 years now. This version of the show, where we have far less resources, far less support staff. What's that?
It's been like 3 years now.
Yes, it's almost 3 years, but I would get your podcast if you charge $5 for the basic, and probably a whole bunch of people would also consider this option. You know, when you wrote this to me 2 years ago, And I wrote you back an email suggesting you have no reason to believe that. You still aren't offering any more evidence. Cliff was right. You can be lazy, she writes me. Think about it. You can do good interviews and have good content, not on a regular basis, however, and not get complaints if the price point was a little better. Thanks for reading. Now, 2 years ago, when this person was a member, she wrote me an extended email telling me that the format's not working for us, because apparently she and her husband were sharing a membership. I don't necessarily have a problem with that, but that brings it down to $5, the price. 2 into 10 is 5. She said that Peter B. Collins and Nicole Sandler do a great job. You need to have longer interviews, she said. We're trying to decide what to do and wanted to include you in the thought process. We also love Marin. His show is still working for us. I know this is negative, but we need a reason not to cancel. I wrote back an email addressing your concerns, but finally saying, I wish I could tell you that I'll change the show or work with you to develop the show so it is more to your liking, but alas, I can't. I really appreciate the support you've given so far and totally understand why you'd cancel if you feel it's not worth it. That was back in 2011. And then in 2012, I've decided that I like Mark's show because of the long, interesting interviews. I've racked my brain to figure out what the difference is for me. I love to listen to Mark. I feel good after his show. The people that like Sam must like short interviews. For me, Sam would get more listeners if he charged for the whole show, where it was an in-depth interview or several depth in-depth interviews. Of course, Sam will not pay attention to me because he likes to play with libertarians at the expense of his listeners. At that point, she said, please read this on air. This is honest feedback. If you tell me to just quit, I will. And my husband, since he paid for this. And Peter B. Collins has different music. I think at that time I said, quit, please. And you did. And now you continue to harangue me. So I am left with no choice but to completely fire you from listening to the free show as well. And sadly, because of what you've done, I am going to have to charge members an extra dollar a month to develop the technology to make sure that you're not able to listen to the show. I imagine this is going to be incredibly costly. I don't even know if the technology is out there, but we will have to develop it, and it will come at great expense to us. And I will assure you that while you think I am lazy in the context of doing the show, I will dedicate the remaining 3 hours a day I have when I'm not working on the show to developing this technology to make it impossible for you to listen even to the free show.
Sam is never lazy when it comes to a vendetta.
That's right. You're going to see an energy from me that you've never seen before. As I learn to code and learn to work the internet, develop Facebook apps and all sorts of other apps and APIs and whatever it is.
Venture capital in Silicon Valley.
I'm going to raise money. All to figure out how to fire you from the free show.
It's amazing. I'm seeing like $1 billion IPO here.
That's right.
This is how I'm started.
That's right. And then once I market that ability and make my millions, then the show will be free and you will not be able to listen to any of it. All right. We're going to take a break. When we come back, Jeff Goodell.
Yeah.
We are back. Sam Seder on the Majority Report on the phone. Jeff Goodell, the writer of the piece in this month's Rolling Stone of Goodbye Miami. By the century's end, rising sea levels will turn the nation's urban fantasy land into an American Atlantis. Welcome to the program, Jeff.
Thanks for having me.
So, I we don't really see enough of this type of reporting, frankly, of really the problems, the actual on the ground problems we're going to be facing with global climate change. And so I really appreciated this piece. Talk to us as to why you write, even more than Silicon Valley, Miami embodies the central technological myth of our time.
Well, the interesting thing about Miami is, you know, it is a place that believes that sort of man and technology has sort of triumphed over nature. In other words, you know, you can just sort of pave over the swamps, divert the water flow through the Everglades, build on land that's, you know, 1 foot above sea level, completely sort of disregard the fact that it's in one of the major hurricane hotspots in the world, and all the implications of suburban sprawl and traffic and everything that's going on around there, and that there will sort of, we will always figure out some way to, you know, get drinking water, to protect the city from hurricanes, that nature is sort of a less powerful force than human ingenuity, and that we can just need to do whatever we need to do to keep the real estate boom going now, and we'll worry about the future at some other time. And there's a kind of hubris about this, about just like throwing the city up without any kind of regard to the consequences of this kind of development.
But I mean, to be fair, it's worked, I guess, up to this point.
Oh, it's a fantastically alive place. It's in one of the most dynamic cities in the country right now. The development is booming there again. You know, it's a real hub for America and Latin America. And that's what makes it such a poignant story, is that this highly dynamic, lively place is not going to last.
Yeah. Okay. Tell us about that part of it. You quote Harold Wanlis, the chairman of the Department of Geological Sciences at UMiami, is saying Miami, as we know it today, is doomed. It's not a question of if; it's a question of when. Tell us the forces that are going to doom Miami as we know it today.
Well, it's really not very complicated. I mean, you know, Miami, 70% of the land in sort of the larger Miami metropolitan area is under 5 feet of elevation above sea level. And, you know, the federal government estimates of sea level rise, which are conservative, show that it could go as high as 6 feet by the end of the century, but many scientists believe they can go even higher than that. So with 6 feet of sea level rise, Miami, as we know it today, is swamped and ceases to exist in any form that we can imagine it happening today. But the interesting thing about the story is that Miami's problems start long before that. They're already having problems with sea level rise and storm surges coming into Miami Beach, flooding out parts of Miami Beach, salt water coming into the underground aquifers that supply the drinking water. So the sort of point of the story about what's going to happen to Miami is that it's not this disaster where all of a sudden it's going to be Atlantis and people are going to be scuba diving into condos and things like that. It's this slow motion disaster that's already happening there and is going to just accelerate as the years move forward.
You know, I mean, there's a lot of when I see, you know, trends. I mean, you know, I sort of imagine, and you talk about this a little bit in the piece, that what we're going to see, and it's weird. I see this in terms of like with just even on the internet with numbers, the way that these things seem to go, and it's the same thing with viruses, is that you have like a slow degradation, then these sort of spikes of disaster, which I imagine we're going to see in the context of like hurricanes, and then it sort of it recedes slightly, but the level of degradation is higher than it was before, and then we're just going to get a series of these spikes that, so we're going to see this slow motion disaster with these moments of I guess contained disasters. Is that the way that the scientists imagine this is going to happen?
Yeah, I mean, I started out the piece imagining what a Category 5 hurricane in the year 2030, when we've had, you know, as much as a foot of sea level rise, what that would do to the city. And one of the things about sea level rise is that it makes all of these storm surges, including high tides, everything from high tides up to, you know, Category 5 hurricanes, that much more damaging, because it carries that, you're carrying that much more water into the city or onto land. And so, yes, you're going to see increasingly devastating flooding from everything from high tides and up to hurricanes. And it's going to be this sort of slow realization that this is not something that is just going to hit once and then go away. As the tide, as the storm waters recede, there will still be problems from these rising tides. And, you know, places like Key West, and there's lots of places in the world where, you know, they've built cities that are sort of elevated and can deal with storm surges that come in and out. But it's another thing to deal with full-time inundation, with actual sort of going submerging of a city. And that's where things get really complicated for Miami. And it's also important to point out that this is not a problem that's only facing Miami. Of course,
right,
coastal cities around the world face this. New York, you know, I first started doing the piece, thinking about the piece, because I was going to write about New York. But then I realized that Miami was more interesting. And the thing that makes Miami different than many, many other places is that it's very difficult to defend against. In a place like New York or Boston or London, there are ways of building seawalls. There are ways of moving to higher ground, relocating, lots of things that can be done. In Miami, there's no real high ground to move to. And because of the porousness of the limestone that the city is built upon, the water will come up behind and underneath the seawall, so there's no real way to protect the city.
And in some respects, Miami is simply going to be, or, you know, and arguably maybe some level, maybe New Orleans was, but I mean, and Sandy on some level, but I mean, Miami is going to be the canary in the coal mine, right? I mean, you're going to be able to build these seawalls, but eventually the question is going to be, can you build them fast enough, and not just from a technological standpoint, but also from a political will standpoint. I mean, you mentioned that there's a certain amount of sort of hubris that is like Silicon Valley, but there's also another level of resistance in Florida that is particularly alarming. Just tell us about what struck out for me was the you speak to Chuck Watson, who's a disaster impact analyst with a lot of experience in Florida. He tells of attending a meeting for natural hazard response planning in South Florida, and then tell us what happens at that meeting.
Well, Chuck is very sort of astute expert in natural disasters, and is very concerned about things like storm surge and sea level rise. Is one of the most articulate people I've talked to. And he described being in a meeting with some state commissioners in South Florida. And, he described some of the stuff that I talked about in my story and tried to urge these politicians to take this seriously and to begin some planning towards that. And one of the state commissioners stood up and, as Chuck said to me, treated him to a 15-minute lecture, the gist of which was that God has already destroyed the planet or destroyed civilization once with floods and has promised not to do it again. And so Chuck should go back and read the Bible and get wise about this. And it's this kind of, and I don't mean to, not all the denialism is as religious-based as that. It's all kinds of varieties of denial. but they all are in Florida. And Florida is one of the epicenters of denial of the scope and depth of the problems that climate challenges face presents for cities like Miami. So basically nothing is being done. Not only is nothing being done, no one can even talk about it, which is, you know, a whole other level of disaster.
Yeah, I mean, I wonder, I mean, I want to just talk a little bit about that denial, because, you know, one is that God will take care of this, or God has already promised to make it not be a problem. And then it's just sort of like it seems to be a series of other types of sort of blind faith that this is all just going to work out. You know, I mean, that's what I sort of find fascinating, in that you do cover all those sort of different levels of denial. But at the end of the day, it's really just sort of people just don't want to imagine this happening because they can't.
Right. I mean, there is something about it, you know, being too catastrophic to even begin to bend your mind around. But it doesn't necessarily have to be that catastrophic. Of course, part of the problem is that no one is preparing for and thinking about it. But I think with sea level rise and the storm surge and things, the things that I'm talking about in this piece, I think sea level rise is very powerful because it's not hypothetical. We already know, everyone knows, any third grader knows that when the temperature heats up, ice melts. And that's basically what's happening in the Arctic and Antarctic, and that's what's driving sea level rise. And there's nothing hypothetical about this. It's just the question is how fast it's going to happen. And one of the kind of, you know, rational denial mechanisms that are in place, like Florida especially, is that, oh, well, yeah, you're right, sea level rise is a problem, but it's not going to be a problem for 100 years. And so I don't really have to deal with it now. And for a politician, of course, you know, it's easy. They have a lot of problems going on at the moment, and they want to push off these long-term things as long as possible. And especially in a place like Florida, where you have, you know, the whole engine of the economy is more development, development, development. And the idea that, you know, well, these beaches aren't going to be here in 30 or 40 years is not something that the sort of a development engine there really wants to hear. Mm-hmm. You know, these beaches and the coastline of Miami is the engine of the economy, really. And the idea of that going away is just, you know, tantamount to, you know, the entire economy going away. So it's a really big thing to get one's head around.
But let me ask you this. What about Holland? Aren't they going to save us?
What about Holland?
Yeah. Aren't the Dutch going to save us? Because they figured this out.
Right. That's part of the technological hubris that we talked about at the very beginning. I mean, certainly the Dutch have done a very good job of living with rising seas in the Netherlands. But 2 points. One is that they've been thinking about this and doing this for, you know, several hundred years. So they have a lot of sophisticated planning and thinking about it. And it's a very much a sort of national cause of dealing with this. And there's no kind of denial about what's at stake there. And second of all, the geology there is much different. They can build walls. They can build dikes. This kind of coastal engineering is possible. The problem with Miami is that it's really not possible. So the idea that you're just going to hire a bunch of Dutch engineers and they're going to come and build seawalls and dikes and everything's going to be jolly is not going to happen. I talked to some of the top experts in the world, Dutch experts, who are very knowledgeable about sea level rise and water management and things, and they've basically thrown their hands up saying, we don't know what we would do or what you could do to save Miami.
Oh, well, so much for the Dutch, I guess. And let's talk about, I mean, I want to also talk about insurance, because my sense is that at one point we're going to start to see in private insurance basically just go away, right? I mean, there's going to be a point where insurance companies are going to say it's just not worth our while to insure places like Miami against what we know is inevitably going to hit.
Yeah, I mean, that's already starting to happen. I mean, after Hurricane Andrew hit Miami in 1992, or hit South Florida in 1992, a lot of big private insurers who offer property insurance pulled out because they just realized the risks were too high and they were not making any money. So people like State Farm and others, Travelers, stopped writing new policies. And the state of Florida had to start basically a subsidized government insurance program in order to keep prices low enough for people to continue living there. But that program called Citizens Insurance is now in big trouble itself. because the subsidized rates are just not enough to cover the actuarial costs of the program. So basically the fear right now is that one big storm, you know, forget all the problems with sea level rise I'm talking about, one big storm, big hurricane hitting South Florida could bankrupt the state because the state's on the hook for so much coverage. But as the future unfolds and as we get more and more problems with flood damage and stuff, this is going to become a bigger and bigger issue. And right now, flooding is covered by a national flood insurance program, but it's like $24 billion in debt right now, and there's a lot of action in Congress trying to reform that. So we know that insurance is either going to get, it's certainly going to get more expensive and in some places more or less impossible to get. And that has huge implications for the development of Florida and for the Florida economy. Because if you can't afford to buy a house on the coastal regions of Florida, you know, that's where everybody wants to live. And, you know, only so many people want to live in Orlando.
And lastly, if it's not the if it's not all of these other elements that that are sort of looming over Miami, just talk to us a little bit about Turkey Point.
Oh, well, yeah, it's true. Turkey Point is the sort of crowning glory of this whole story in a way. Turkey Point is a big nuclear plant that's built. It's about 20 miles south of Miami, and it's basically right on the water's edge, right at sea level. And it's just a major disaster waiting to happen. It has been, you know, some of the reactors and other critical equipment has been elevated 10 or 15 feet in order to protect it from some storm surges. But in the long run, this nuclear plant is doomed and is going to be essentially even 2 or 3 feet of sea level rise would sort of isolate the plant on what would amount to an island in the middle of Biscayne Bay. And the great irony of this whole thing and suggestive of just how out of touch both the utility company that's trying to build the plant and the politicians that are allowing it is they're on the verge of building two more new nuclear reactors at this same spot, which would be around for 50 or 60 or 70 years, well into the era when, you know, the seas are predicted to rise high enough to cause major problems. So you can imagine what a kind of a Fukushima-like event would be like in a place like Turkey Point when the sea levels are that much higher and it's harder to get out to them and everything like that.
I mean, this is sort of almost one of the most chilling aspects of it. The idea that they could be building more when we know now, just reports this week, that Fukushima is still leaking into the ocean. And right. Leaking radioactive material into the ocean, and you know, which side of Florida is Turkey Point on? In other words, you know, this is where, you know, this is one of those things where this disaster, if it ever takes place at a place like Turkey Point, is not just going to be for Florida. It's going to be either for the entire eastern seaboard, probably as north as, you know, I don't know, who knows how far north it could go, but also presumably the Gulf, right? I mean,
right.
This stuff is not going to just sit there off the coast of Miami. It's going to go somewhere else.
Right. Right. Well, I mean, you know, there's all kinds of levels of nuclear disasters, from relatively modest releases to full-scale catastrophes. But I think the larger point is that this is, and I'm not anti-nuke. I mean, I do think there's a place for nukes in our energy system, but this is an example of why people are anti-nuke, because
right.
This is just an insane place to have a plant, and the only sensible thing is to begin to phase it out and get rid of it. And move it somewhere safer. But instead, they're doing the opposite, which is making it bigger and trying to add more reactors to the same spot.
Well, Jeff, the piece is really, I really appreciate the piece because I think it sort of really outlines the myriad of problems that we're going to have. And it's, again, you know, you're right to point out, and I think this is why the piece is so important, that this is not just about Miami. These are implications. We're going to have these implications in one form or another throughout really the world. You know, we're going to see either communities go bankrupt because of this, or massive disasters, or simply, you know, cities that just disappear.
Right. And, you know, the bigger tragedy is, of course, that, you know, there's ways of preparing for this. There's ways of thinking ahead and making this not so bad. London's a great example. London's a very vulnerable city. But they've done amazing work in looking straightforwardly at what sea level rise and storm surges, the consequences for that could be for the city, planning to increase the barriers on the Thames, building political power, political support for that. They're an example of a place that's really doing it right. And New York, too. I mean, New York, with Mayor Bloomberg, has released this climate adaptation plan. It's talking about $20 billion spending to basically adapt to this changing climate and make New York a kind of viable city for the next 100 years. And, you know, the tragedy is that places like Miami have nothing of that, not even close. They aren't even having a conversation about that, much less actually putting any muscle into it.
Is that where we are now? It's basically like we just got to figure out how to deal with this, because there's going to be absolutely no way to mitigate it or foreclose the chance of this being our future?
No, I mean, I think that we're certainly into the stage where we do have to think about adaptation and what we're going to do. I think that it's pretty clear to every scientist that looks at this that you know, especially things like sea level rise are essentially unstoppable. Jason Box, a really great glaciologist who I was actually just in Greenland with a few weeks ago, estimates that even if we stopped emitting greenhouse gases today, we would still have 70 feet of sea level rise baked into the heat that's already in the system. The question is how long that would take, you know, 100 years, 200 years, however long, but we're not going to stop this. So we do need to prepare for these kinds of changes, but it doesn't mean that cutting greenhouse gases is not really, really important, because we could also slow down this change in the system and come closer to preserving a sort of habitable climate for our kids and grandkids.
Jeff Goodell, the piece is Goodbye Miami. Can't recommend the piece enough. It is a if it's likely to happen, is it really dystopian image of Miami? I don't know. I'm not. But Jeff, thank you so much for talking to us about it.
Thanks for having me.
All right, folks, before we head into the better half of the program, I wanted to make sure that we had time to play this clip from Elizabeth Warren on CNBC the other day. It's an extended clip. It's 5 minutes long. But it is really just fantastic, so much so that even Jim Cramer tweeted out yesterday, there's this weird idea that Elizabeth Warren somehow bested CNBC yesterday, she is on there talking about the introduction of a new Glass-Steagall bill, and we can talk more about, for those who are not familiar, as to why we need this now. I think it's quite obvious in terms of Too Big to Fail has gotten even bigger than it was. And the implications, some will argue that it may or may not have stopped the financial crisis of 2008, but it certainly would have helped mitigate its impact in many respects. But here is Elizabeth Warren on with the CNBC morons, and it was really enjoyable. And understand, too, that Glass-Steagall would probably also in some ways inhibit CNBC's value to its dwindling viewership, because it just the go-go, you know, when you don't have the resources that you have when you have joined forces with a commercial bank and you're an investment bank, it probably makes you a little bit more conservative in your choices. At the very least, you have far less ability to do as much systemic damage. But here is that clip now.
Senator, I'm going to just jump in here and ask you what you would say to some of the criticisms of your proposed bill here. For example, we were speaking to Chris Whalen earlier on today from Carrington Investment Services, and he was saying it would be hugely disruptive to impose this new Glass-Steagall. And one of the things that he says could be a result is it would really hurt credit creation, which obviously in turn would hurt the economy. What would you say, for example, to that?
You know, that was pretty much what the banks were saying back in 1932 and 1933. They kept saying no, no, no to Glass-Steagall. They raised all kinds of objections to it. And they kept hammering away at it because they wanted to be able to get access to those deposits in order to fuel more speculative trading. And what this says is no, we can't do that. If you're going to have FDIC insurance, you're going to have savings accounts and checking accounts. They really do have to be walled off. Remember, we had 50 years following the passage of Glass-Steagall in which we had a tiny number of bank failures. That whole boom and bust cycle from 1797 to 1933 went away. And in that period of time, we built a strong, robust middle class. What happened is we started chipping away, and part of the chipping away at that was to say, load up the banks with more and more risk, get them more integrated, and let them get bigger and bigger. And when that happened, we were in the position of having to bail them out when they got into big financial trouble.
Senator, I will push back, though, on the relative security that you're portraying Glass-Steagall to have given us, because Continental Illinois in the early 80s was the seventh largest bank in America. It failed, almost set off basically another major banking crisis. Shouldn't we just tell the American consumer that no matter what we do, there will be bank boom and bust cycles, no matter what the laws and regulations? You can't protect.
Okay, before now, Elizabeth Warren has a response to this, but the response that occurred to me was that the guy said, we almost had a banking crisis. So we had one of the largest banks in the country go under, and we almost had a banking crisis. I wonder what it was that prevented it from being a systemic crisis. I wonder. This guy barking up the wrong tree and clearly just has, you know, this is one of those instances, and we mentioned it with Josh Fox on the program yesterday when he went up against Niall Ferguson on Bill Maher, where you love to see someone who has an inch deep worth of awareness of what the issue is because they've gotten talking points against someone who really does know what they're talking about. And here's Elizabeth Warren responding.
Everything. No. That is just wrong.
Why?
Look at the history.
I have looked at history. We were filled with booms and busts from the Dutch tulip crisis to now.
From 1797 to 1933, the American banking system crashed about every 15 years. In 1933, we put good reforms in place for which Glass-Steagall was the centerpiece. And from 1933 to the early 1980s, that's a 50-year period, we didn't have any of that. None. We kept the system steady and secure. And it was only as we started deregulating. You start hitting the S&L crisis, and what did we do? We deregulated some more. And then you hit long-term capital management at the end of the 90s, and what did we do as a country? This country continued to deregulate more. And then we hit the big crash in 2008. You are not going to defend the proposition that regulation can never work.
I didn't say regulation never worked, Senator, by far and away, and I agree, there were fewer bank failures in that time after Glass-Steagall.
Of the big ones, zero.
But Continental Illinois was the seventh biggest bank in the United States when it failed.
It took 50 years to get there.
But, Senator, you're on the record saying Glass-Steagall would not have prevented the financial crisis.
Not all by itself, that's absolutely right. But what Glass-Steagall can do is it can wind some more of the risk out of the system. It can help bring down the size of the largest banking institutions. Don't forget, you said there was too much concentration in the banking industry in 2008. Now here we are in 2013, and the big four are 30% bigger. That puts too much risk back in the system.
Well, there's other ways of shrinking them, obviously. But
with all due respect, Senator, every report I've read, every person I've spoken to says that there's a very, very, very slim chance of this even passing.
Well, let me put it this way. If you don't fight for it, the chances are zero.
I love this. Well, now that we've decided that we can't really comment on that, we can't make the argument that your policy is bad, do you think there's any chance of it passing? I remind you that I do not know that these CNBC people have ever said to a single Republican congressperson, hey, you've tried to repeal Obamacare 67 times. It has failed. Why do you guys keep doing this? This is the first time this bill is going to come up.
Remember who my partners are in this one. I've got John McCain standing with me. I couldn't ask for a better fighter. We've got Maria Cantwell. We've got Angus King. We've got a Democrat, a Republican, an Independent. All people who are willing to get out
Senator,
there and
you
fight.
You know what the prospects are. The House has voted 37 times to... on Obamacare to defund it, and is this any different? I mean, you're making a statement, but we want Congress to do things that actually have a chance of happening and become law.
You know, is this any different? And now the fact is, it's actually been 67, but this guy says 37. Is it any different to try and bring this up in a bipartisan fashion one time in the Senate as opposed to what the Republicans are doing? I mean, this is just.
Also, he brought up the Obamacare thing to Elizabeth Warren. I doubt he's ever brought it up to a
Republican. Go ahead.
This seems like more of the same. Go ahead.
No, but I was just going to say, you know, I remember going on television multiple times, including here, when I talked about the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau, when the big banks were spending more than $1 million a day lobbying against it, and when everybody told me, you'll never get that thing through. Why are you even trying? The chances of passing it are slim to none. And yet, look around. We now have a good, strong Consumer Financial Protection Bureau. It's recovered $500 million for families who got cheated. It's out there working on behalf of military families, on behalf of seniors, on behalf of students. We got that agency because we got out and fought for it. I actually believe in that.
Well, okay. Well, we've got to move on. And so, of course, this is what I want to read just again. Jim Cramer's tweet from yesterday. There's some weird strain of thought that CNBC got beaten by Senator Warren. I like the senator, but she had no capital N-O impact. There you go, folks. All right. Well,
let me tell you, I've seen this video passed so much that I'll guarantee you the impact of this interview has brought awareness to that bill.
Absolutely.
Unbelievable.
Absolutely. Not only did she not have no impact, I would imagine this is a surprising net gain for the chances of this bill to pass, particularly since had she not handed it to him, nobody would have seen this video because nobody watches CNBC.
There's always a powerful end to a debate when you're just like, huh.
Huh. Well,
had no impact on me.
Let's go back to pushing Lehman Brothers. I think this is a buy. Oh, wait, did they still? Okay. All right, we got to take a break, head into the better half of the program. The number is 646-257-3920, 646-257-3920. Give you an update on who those National Labor Relations Board appointees were. The op-ed written by the grandfather of Anwar al-Awlaki, I should say the grandfather of the 16-year-old boy who was killed in a drone strike, the 16-year-old U.S. citizen killed in a drone strike because apparently he was born of a father that we wanted to also kill and did. More on the minimum wage when we come back, and this story about the Affordable Care Act may cause people to quit their job, or I should say may allow people to quit their job. It'll be interesting to see if the right wing actually uses this as a talking point in the future. Number 646-257-3920. You can IM me at Majority FM. We'll be back in just a moment.